All right, are you gonna host today, or am I hosting?
It's all you. You're the best host.
Hey, I listened to our last episode, by the way. I was expecting a little more accusations of fraud, and you guys just kind of hinted that I was a fraud. I'm insulted.
We didn't want like all of your, you know, CEOs and LPs and like everybody who's probably like 40% of the listenership of this podcast to be like, wait, Michael, is this, should we have a one-on-one about this? So we just wanted to save you from extemporaneous meetings and we sort of held back, which is good.
They do business with me. They don't listen to me. Slightly different
things. That's good. Okay. So we can let it fly next time. That's good to know.
Cool. All right. So today we decided, since Alex isn't here, to talk about Venture Studios. And I think it came up in one of our group chats last week. And then I tweeted about Venture Studios last week, maybe after our group chat. It was good.
Yeah. So here's how this came up, right? So I was at this dinner a couple of weeks ago. And I was like, it's hosted by this really wealthy guy, and he has this like incredible space. And all of these like pretty legit VCs and CEOs were showing up to the space. And it's like three or four stories in like prime real estate in San Francisco. And I was just like looking around, like, what is this? And somebody's like, oh, it's a studio model. Like this one guy owns the entire thing. He leases the space. He has all these companies that come in here. And then so Michael and I started talking in our group chat about like how many rich people do this or dream of doing it, and why it's probably 99% of the time a terrible idea, right?
Yeah.
I think that's how this came up.
For sure. Okay, so let's make sure we're on the same page. Like, how do you define what a venture studio is? Like, what's your definition?
I think the way that I look at it is it's taken a lot of different twists and turns, but in my model or in my mind, it is some sort of a model that is a company that incubates or creates companies. And I think that there's a lot of different branches of that, like you, and we'll get into this, but you have venture capital firms who usually are meeting people with an idea and hopefully some traction now that it's 2023. For a while, you didn't have to have an idea or traction, but now you have to have both. But VCs will famously kind of have their own ideas. And if they can't find the right founder to work on them, they will incubate this idea internally. They'll go out and find the founder. I think other firms like Atomic pretty famously have a giant list of their own ideas where they are like just they know the ideas. They are just putting founders on the ideas and sort of giving the founders a certain percentage of the company. And then you have sort of a bunch of hybrid situations where it's sort of, you know, we will provide capital, but you need to apply to us with an idea. It sort of looks like a little bit more of like a Y Combinator type model. But yeah, it's right. A company that is spinning out companies as opposed to a private equity model, which is typically a company that is, you know, buying companies or shares of companies.
Well, and I think with this kind of space where you have like vulnerable people and potential investors, like it recruits some people or attracts some people that are, I would describe as unsavory. Like you'll see that when you look. When you like Google this model, you'll see people who are like using it as an angle to sell services or screw other people over, or just your typical like hucksters who show up in startup land and are like, hey, I need 30% of your company for being an advisor. Like that kind of stuff is pretty.
Yeah. I mean, still dumb. Today, I have one of the best people I've ever worked with in my career. One of these guys where I've tried to get him to work for me for years. And I know he's smart because he won't work for me. Which makes him, you know, incredible judgment, right? And, you know, he's like, he's just incredibly well-rounded. He's not a CEO. He's at a big company still. But like he will someday, I think, be a great CEO. And these venture studios, probably once every 3 or 6 months, they see his background. They see like all of these incredible experiences that he's had in tech. And they'll reach out to him and they'll say, hey, we would love for you to basically be a portfolio CEO. You know, we have our own list of ideas. We have some capital. And I mean, the model is like on some of these venture firms in 2023, or some of these startup studios rather, it's like a 50-50 split. And like they've researched that the startup studio has quote unquote like researched or diligenced the idea. I doubt that there's been that much time or effort put into that. It's sort of like, oh, here's a thing that's probably a good idea, but it's ultimately on you as the founder to take it on. And the amount of capital that you're getting relative to a seed stage company applying to a VC firm or to an incubator is like a fraction of the cash. And so you're, it's naturally going to kind of attract these predatory people who are like, I'm going to get 50% of all these companies. And that totally screws with the cap table of these companies forever. And I think that that's one of the reasons that, you know, this industry has been hindered. Now, there's certainly people doing, I think, better and more interesting models in the space. But I think that one of the reasons we just haven't seen a lot of successes coming out of startup studios is just like out of the gates, they're taking too much ownership of these companies and probably not giving the founders a long enough runway of cash to actually go execute.
For sure. Yeah. And it's so bizarre how many variations there are of these startup studios, right? Like you have like everything from the dinner you went to, which doesn't really sound like a real, but doesn't sound very serious. It sounds like a playground. I mean, that's,
it's I mean, I think you, and that's the other thing to, I think to cover here, you have in the startup studio model, you typically have one of three things is what I've seen. You have a singular rich guy. I think I think HVF, which is Max Levkin's, I think, I don't know if he eventually took on outside investors, but Max Levkin, who was part of the PayPal mafia, he started this venture studio, I think 12 years ago, called HVF, which I think stood for hard, valuable, and fun, which was like his mantra of companies that he wanted to work on. That company ended up creating a firm. So you have like rich guy who just puts his money in startup studio, gets a sweet space, tries to get all the like 22-year-old Stanford kids to come down and work out of it and create companies, and then he takes a percentage. I think in other cases, you have a pool of rich people where it's like five friends doing this, and that I think was sort of the basis of Atomic and I think Science Labs and some of these other ones. And then you have, I think, the more traditional model of, I think like High Alpha and some of these are structured with basically a like investment committee who is deciding on which founders are going to back, which ideas they're going to work on. And then it's structured like a typical fund where you have all these, you know, limited partners of other rich people and pension funds and private equity funds and stuff like that sort of backing. So these individual startup studios that are run by like rich guy with ideas, I think have been the least successful. The most successful startup studios, I think, tend to be the ones that have a lot of like management and structure and process to actually like validating both the ideas and also, kind of attracting the right founders.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you like Pioneer Square Labs as like the best example of that methodical stuff? That's like the Aquarium
I think so.
Are the Atomic guys? Is that
who? You know what's interesting is so... On startup studios, I went in my 7 minutes of preparation that I always, you know, do in diligence of this podcast. I went out, and this is like this perfectly describes startup studios, and it basically it reaffirms my decision that this is probably a bad model. And I'll make one exception, but what I did is I said, what are the biggest venture studios and startup studios, and what are the big successes out of those? And there's this guy named Craig Cronenberger, who writes this blog called The Startup Studio Insider. And I was reading through his blog, and he has this list of like 20 or 30 startup studios. You've got Atomic, BetaWorks, Coplex, eFounders, Expa, High Alpha, PSL, Rocket Internet Science. The list goes on and on. And then there's the like the best companies out of each of those. I had heard of three of these 100 companies.
Yeah.
Right. You just, you know, there's this massive list. Like these are the handpicked best companies that these studios are creating. And I you just haven't heard of them. I think the one that comes up as a, you know, the two that I hear that come up as pretty outlier successes are Dollar Shave Club, which went public, and then Hims and Hers, which went public and is currently sitting at like a $2 billion valuation. So, you know, for an entire category, those individual companies are super impressive. But if you look at the dynamics of like how these studios need to make money long term, and the entire industry has sort of pumped out like 10 unicorns, a lot of which are paper unicorns, it's not a very good model. The exception to that, I think, are in the drug and biotech industry. There's a company that is crushing it that I just learned about called Flagship Pioneering. This company, Flagship Pioneering, has spun out four public companies worth between like $2 and $12 billion, including Moderna, over the last 5 years. So this company has just like found the niche of biotech, life sciences, health, and sustainability, and they are going all in. It's a 20-year-old company run by this billionaire named Noubar Afeyan, who's this like Lebanese guy out of Cambridge. I've never heard of this company before, but they are crushing it relative to all of these consumer and B2B plays, which seem to be like kind of womp womp.
If you think about biotech and bioengineering, like the risk there is usually much more a technology risk.
Yeah.
Like, can we patent this molecule? Can we find this whatever? Which I think is the opposite of consumer or B2B or software, right? Where there it's market risks. And like it seems, I understand that. So if you have like in the case of Flagship Pioneering, you have like a big lab, right? It's like, okay, well, like I see the value you can add there. Like you're going to shoulder a lot of the development cost risk and all that kind of stuff and have a network and leverage that kind of stuff. But market risk doesn't work that way.
Yep.
So that makes me think that, oh, like, okay, well, yeah, I buy it, at least theoretically, right, and not having an MD or anything.
Yeah. And then the other model that seems to work really well are very well-funded, established venture firms that are creating their own ideas. And it often, I think that these are pretty tried and true ideas, mostly in the B2B space, but there's a couple like in the consumer space that have broken out. I think Sutter Hill Ventures is probably the best known for this. They spun out Snowflake at a $40 billion valuation and Pure Storage at a $4 billion valuation, both of which are, I think, much bigger today. So that model also works, where it's like, we deeply understand this problem. We have the right kind of expertise within our firm to go attract the right CEO. And then also there's, contrary to the typical startup studio model space, there's enough equity given to the founders where the founders can actually then play a long game with it and go raise additional venture capital. And it doesn't become this like dead on day one company that has sold 50% of itself for a $500,000 check that gets them, you know, 4 months of runway, which is, you know, the typical model here.
Yeah. Well, you talked about this idea that like the hit rate is still very low in this industry. Like, let's say your hit rate to become a billion-dollar company is 0.1%, and being part of a startup studio makes it 0.3%. But, like, it's interesting to me, like, if you look at Sutter Hill in particular and how they do it, right? Like, they're a venture fund, but they don't have LPs anymore. It's an evergreen fund, so it's all their money, which, by the way, must be nice. And then they'll take and they'll go just work on like one or two ideas a year and like go get their head really, really deep into it and then spend two or three like years incubating this thing. Or they'll find somebody that they know from their network who's a badass and like have them in the office for like a year and a half before they even start working on anything. And then the pipeline that they have where they're connected to like people that worked at Yahoo or Google or Facebook. And like, if Google has built something internally, like they just say, okay, well, we're going to build that for the rest of the market. And so there's all these different things that they've done around that kind of thing. But like, I think it comes back to this idea, like it's really hard to identify like what's actually working. Like if you're doing startups as an output, it's really, there's no like common pattern here. You have everything from, you know, these random consumer things. You have Idea Lab and some of the old school venture studios. And it's like, there's no obvious pattern of what works. It's not like the accelerator format where it's like, okay, like you're here for 3 months. We connect you with mentors. We give you ideas. And then we show you to seed investors and mark up your valuation 5 times from when you came into the program. Like that works. And we know that works. But like, there's no pattern here. Or if there's a pattern, am I missing it? Like, I just don't see it.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think the new shiny thing syndrome is very real here, right? Yeah. I mean, I think this is what I think it works in venture capital and it works to a certain extent in private equity. Cause with VC, you have a, you know, $100 million fund. Your job is to constantly be looking for the new shiny thing. I think that like the people that are attracted into these industries, that like the person that got rich from taking, you know, his company public and making $1 billion. Like the reason that he wants to create a startup studio, I think, is because you don't have concentration on a single thing over 10 years. It's very attractive to say, I'm going to work on 20 different things at the same time. And I think that there are like much better models for that, which I think like you've seen in your own career, whether that's like a holding company or private equity or something else. But like the startup studio model, just it's not putting enough focus on the right thing for long enough to make it successful. I think that's what I've been convinced after looking at the space. Like the ideas that Atomic and Science and stuff like that are throwing out there in the consumer space aren't bad. It's just, I think most of their companies are getting crushed because you have this, you're competing with like a crazy founder who probably still owns 80% of their company in the early days, who has like a ton of incentive to see this thing through for a very long time, versus this person that sort of got like recruited into the CEO role. They don't have a ton of upside, and all of the ideation and help that was there in the early days, like those rich guys have like moved on to the next company. Like you're not getting a ton of their time, I have to imagine. So there's a ton of problems with it, but I think it's very smart, wealthy people keep getting attracted to this model. And I do think somebody will figure it out. I think that there's a lot of finessing that needs to happen. I think the Sutter Hill guys are pretty close to it now that they're running, you know, that they've kind of gotten rid of LPs and it's their money or mostly their money. The ability to like put crazy things into the world and then double down on them for a very long, like permanent period of time is kind of what you need to make a company work, I think. So at least like a venture scale company.
Yeah. And I mean, that may be the problem with all of this, right? Like if you think about, like, I look at some of the successes, right? Like Rocket Internet is one. You're familiar with Rocket Internet?
Yep.
Telling the story, so I'll just do it real fast. But
you got to share the story.
It was these guys in Berlin, the Samware brothers. And by the way, I didn't even read about this. This is how famous these guys are. I didn't even read about this preparing for today's episode. But like basically their whole model for the past 15 years was like they would see what startups were working well and then replicate them exactly like in some other country. It's like, oh, you're Uber for United States? Great. We're doing it for France. Like you're eBay for America? Great. We're doing it in Japan. Like, and that was their whole model. But like, it was such a good racket. Like I loved that racket of just that idea, you know, type copying of it. But like, I don't know where I was going with the Samware brothers, but I got so excited to tell the story. What was I talking about before?
Well, I mean, I think we were talking about how you need to, you know, you need to run these ideas over a very long period of time. Oh, yeah. and find, yeah, the kind of the right person to run them.
Yeah. I mean, and that works, but like, it just keeps coming back this idea. Like I think there's so much risk where if you're doing some sort of innovative thing, that's going to be a changer of the world. Like Airbnb is like the greatest success ever to come out of Y Combinator out of like the 1500 companies they've done. I mean, how many companies have they done that? Like 4,000 or something stupid.
Yeah, 3,000.
Cause they're taking
plus.
Like 400 or 500 a batch for a while, twice a year. So they're doing 1,000 companies a year for the past 5 years. So like if you're doing a venture studio, like number one, you have to be okay doing an idea that sounds kind of dumb, because Airbnb, like frankly, it sounded kind of dumb at the beginning and it morphed over time to be something that made a lot more sense. But you have to do that. And then at most, because you're incubating the thing, you can do 4 or 5 companies a year, maybe. And like you're competing against the 2,000, you know, the 2,000 companies that come out of every 2 years out of Y Combinator. And that's just a small sample of people that get into Y Combinator, you know, and you have to be comfortable doing a dumb idea. Like to me, it just kind of comes down to the core of, I don't know that doing a venture studio for venture-backed startups is like the numbers work. Like I just don't see it. Like you just can't do enough deals.
Yeah, you know why my theory of Rocket Internet? So a fun story, I met Oliver Samore, who's one of the three Samore brothers that ran Rocket Internet. And I don't even remember why. The only thing that I remember distinctly about him from this meeting like 7 years ago is we were in a very nice hotel doing this meeting, just he and I. And I think he had like an assistant or something sitting at like a table over from us. But it was just him and I. And he ordered a coffee. I think it was like a cappuccino. He sent it back 3 times because they got it wrong. It's just a fun fact about Oliver and kind of the way that he, you know, lives his life, I guess, is like he's sending drinks back 3 times.
Let's unpack this. What could be wrong with I've never, ever, ever seen somebody send a cappuccino back.
It's
how wrong could it be?
I can't even, I think we were in like the cafe at the W or the Four. I mean, it was a very nice hotel. So it wasn't like the problem couldn't have been that the barista or bartender, whoever was making this coffee at 10:30 in the morning, didn't know how to make a cappuccino. And I don't think it was a crazy cappuccino. I think it was just a cappuccino. And I think that there was an issue with the level of milk to the espresso and how foamy I just remember him getting not angry, but upset with the waitress that this drink had to be sent back again because it wasn't perfect. And it was very embarrassing being in the presence of that. So I don't know. That's my Sam Warbrothers story. I don't even remember what the meeting was about. They might have been trying to like invest in us or copy us or something like that at the time.
Dude, I mean, that's one of the things I don't like about living in San Antonio. Like you get to go, you have like these random brushes with like insanity in these big markets and nobody goes to San Antonio. Like that reality distortion field doesn't happen.
The Sam Warbrothers don't know what San Antonio is, but that's okay. That's good for other reasons. So you know what I think it is, the Rocket Internet guys, this is my theory. The Rocket Internet business worked for a long time. To your Airbnb example, like it has to be a wild, outlandish idea and you have to get a lot of like minutia right for this thing to work. They were doing Airbnb in Indonesia. And for a while, I think the Airbnb guys were going, okay, like we don't want to have to compete with you in Indonesia. We'll just buy Airbnb for Indonesia for $30 million. So that's a great business. If you're just like hiring some senior Airbnb guy away, which is what they would do, they would often like hire like an underpaid, undervalued VP away from the actual company, say, we're going to make you CEO of like this new company. We're going to pay you a lot of money and you're going to go figure this out in you know, Britain or Indonesia or somewhere in Africa or whatever. And for a while, these companies were actually consistently, like eBay was doing this. I think Instacart bought a couple, Airbnb bought a couple. I remember Groupon got hit hard with this. The Sam Warbrothers were going after Groupon in every market. And I just remember going to this like SV Angel talk with Andrew Mason, who was like the recently fired CEO of Groupon at the time, who's incredible. And he told this whole story about the Sam Warbrothers and Rocket Internet copying his company in like 14 markets and then trying to like sell the individual entities back to him. And I think this was like 2011, 2012 when Rocket Internet was at its height. And he was like, I was scared shitless. Like I thought that we were just going to lose every market. And the only place that Groupon would ever be big was the US. And he was like, I just said no. And so what happens is when all the CEOs collectively, they do this like collective bargaining. And I think a lot of their venture investors press them to do this. Like just stop buying the entities. They have no exit path. Like the like second biggest Airbnb competitor, Vrbo, doesn't want to like snap up like a exact Airbnb replica. Like they were creating exit opportunities. And I think when the exit opportunities dried up because the CEOs were like, no, we'll just hire our own team in Indonesia. Like if we lose it to you, good on you guys. But they never meant to do this over the long run. It's not like they actually had a thesis like we think we can do something differently than Airbnb to make it better for Indonesia. It's like, no, we're just Airbnb for Indonesia. So like they were always a couple months behind on like, new designs, new features coming down the pipeline. And the only exciting thing was like flipping this company for, you know, tens of millions of dollars back to the entity. And when everybody just said no, I think the entire model started to fail. That's sort of my thesis on why they were once good and then they failed to be good.
It's very reminiscent of NFTs. Like everybody thought it was good until nobody thought it was good. And it's like, oh, okay, well here it works. Like the whole world kind of figured it out.
Yeah, exactly.
I think you look through and it's like you read the websites for these things, like it's incredibly nebulous, like super nebulous, where it's just like, you know, we'll go do market research and then we'll find the idea and then we'll build the founding team. It's like, well, what does all that mean? Like when you double click on each one of those steps, right? Like, and I think that kind of ties back to something like I've learned over the past couple of years. Like every time I've tried to incubate something, and I'm interested in this topic because I do this, right? Like I see an idea and then I figure out how not to be the person running it. Like, because I want to be part of the idea generation. I've run companies. I don't need to run any more companies.
Operations suck.
I think it's more than that. It's like, It's like my buddy described it once when he was a little bit older than me, and I asked him why he didn't want to be CEO anymore. Like, and he basically said, it's time for somebody else to be in the hot seat. And it's like, I think I'm at a stage in life where I want to spend my time helping with hard problems and supporting leaders and helping them grow. Like, I've done my tours of duty to where I've been a CEO multiple times. And I'm like, okay, well, like, I know I could do that, but like my journey and my path is taking me someplace else.
Yep.
And anyway, that's just a long-winded way of saying like, how do I figure out how to put this stuff together? And I think the data point I would share is like, every time it's been my idea, it's gone to crap. Like that we've pursued something and like I've worked on finding a founder or whatever. The only time it's ever worked is when it's our idea. And it can't be just the person's idea. It can't just be my idea. Like we have to go figure out what the idea is going to be together. So like I look at these places that are like, we find the idea, then we go find the team, then we go make it happen, then we raise money for them. I'm like there is no, when that happens, there is no emotional investment by that hired gun. Even if you give them 50% of the company, like they just don't feel that way about the idea that you feel about the idea. Like they have to be there for figuring out what that concept's going to be for it to work. And anyway, it just ties back to why I just like, I'm still so confused by this whole concept. maybe that's why it's not working. It's pretty wild.
Yeah. And it feels like that. That's such a good point. And it's been tried and true across so many models. I mean, for several batches, Y Combinator would allow founders to apply without an idea. And Michael Seibel and Gary Tan, the guys that are running YC now, they've talked about this publicly. They were like, you know, YC hasn't made a ton of operational mistakes. That was like a big mistake that they admitted to. It was the same thing. It was just like, we don't want to get into it, but like, you have to have an idea. You can have multiple ideas. You'll probably pivot during the batch. Like when GPT came out, 40% of the batch pivoted mid-batch. But like you have to have something that you believe in, and ideally you have multiple things you believe in. So when the first thing doesn't work, you have like, optionality other than just like completely giving up. So yeah, I think that that's a huge part of like, people get rich in one area and they assume that they are equally good at everything else, which is probably like the core problem of studios. I got rich doing this one super niche, super crazy thing, and I made lots and lots of money from doing it. And therefore, my ideas in healthcare and Web3 and media are all equally valuable.
Right. Well, and you're suddenly rich, like you don't have the fire you had anymore.
Yeah.
Like if you don't have to work anymore and you get to drive a Ferrari and like women talk to you because you have a lot of money, like where's the hunger? You know, it's not like when you and your buddies were in Y Combinator and that's all you were working on. Like,
yeah. So I'm convinced now after going to this dinner that similar to having a friend who has a Ferrari, having a friend who has a yacht, it's good to know people who are running startup studios because they're probably burning a ton of their own money. They're throwing really sick dinners. They're getting like all the best people together in a room. And like, I don't have to invest a cent. Right. If it goes well, good on them. You know, the guy who's worth a billion makes 1.1 billion now, 1.2 billion now. If it all goes to shit, he's probably now worth 800 million instead of a billion. Great to be friends with this guy. Would never want to do it with my own money.
Yeah. It's, yeah, 100%. Okay. So I want to talk about like the two patterns that I think, as I think about, okay, looking at these ones that actually have worked. And I think there's two, right? I think there's Sutter Hill. And then the other one is Kevin Ryan. So Alicorp.
Yep.
Are you familiar with Alicorp, Kevin Ryan?
Yeah, I am a little bit. But if you have some dirt, I'm sure some of the audience is unfamiliar.
So I wrote a thread on it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I went and studied like everything he had done, read his interviews and stuff like that. And like there were a number of like principles that came out of it, right? Like the one thing I like, I like that he would go like find a trend, like, oh, like, okay, there's a globalization of engineering talent, right? Like, and like he says, okay, well, given that first order change, what's a second order change, right? And so, like, that's how like I started the offshore hiring company, right? It's like, okay, here's this globalization of talent, like, how do we like help people do that? And then along the way, like, all of my friends were having trouble, like, had no clue how to hire overseas.
Yeah.
And then the second thing, like, like he would actually, and this is what he said he does, by the way, there's like a cliffhanger at the end of this. You know, then there was the, okay, well, let's go try this, right? Let's go make a limited bet and let's go see if anybody wants to buy like our solution. And then I think that's where like that rushing to revenue as quickly as possible, rushing to market as quickly as possible, like that's a principle like I totally get. Mm-hmm. And then supposedly like he like, you know, puts together a great team and then he stays involved. Okay. Well, like, again, we're back to this thing. It's like, what the hell does it mean? And so, or what does it mean in practice? And so that's where kind of the denouement of this whole thing is it's like, okay, well, like my DMs flooded with like people who like know firsthand and they're like, no, it's just luck. Yeah. His whole process is, here's his process, getting really lucky. Like that's his process. It's like, oh man, like that's crazy. but again, it's so interesting how like there's this like dichotomy, this big split of like, here's what people say the narrative is of the magic of this person's assembling, and then in the background everybody's like, no, not great. Like he just rolled snake eyes 14 times in a row. How this works.
That's insane. Yeah, the Kevin Ryan thing is wild to me because it's a small team. Like, I think what you want to see is, or what you expect to see, like with Sutter Hill, all of Sutter Hill's stuff is like very closely clustered in terms of like what they do. They do this like very kind of like intense, like B2B SaaS model. When you have these other models, like with Flagship Pioneering, they're all biotech companies, right? They're all like gene therapy and mRNA stuff. This, like Kevin Ryan is frustrating, I think, to watch as an entrepreneur. And I think a lot of people get trapped and obsessed with like what he's doing because the bets are so unrelated, right? He's got like MongoDB and then he's got Guilt Group and then he's got Nomad Health, which is a staffing company. He's got Business Insider, which is a media company. He's got Humming Homes, which is a home building company. So I think these people that like want to create these, you know, baby Berkshire type companies, this like diversified portfolio, it's a very attractive model to be like, well, Kevin Ryan did it, because none of the things have anything to do with one another. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah. Well, and so look, I'm the poster child personally for like the potpourri of business ventures. So, which maybe for good or bad, you know,
fireworks, coffee, software. I mean, I can see how all these things go together.
Staffing, yeah. Education, yeah. They're all related. Totally. Yeah. I do think there is a level of consistency across all of those, but there's a fundamental difference. And I think something between what these startup studios are doing and like what a business studio does or a venture studio. And like, for me, like I looked at what these startup studios were doing and I'm like, man, like they're still fighting the law of large numbers. Like they're competing against highly motivated founders. Like, they're having to do, you know, I think it's, when I looked at it, I was like, this is so telling that all of these venture studios end up as venture firms, like BetaWorks, Pioneer Square Labs. They end up as just seed funds, right? And their big wins are things where they wrote third-party checks into things. And for me, I said, oh, like, you know what I don't want to do? Like I don't want to try to incubate companies that are going to get on a venture path. Like, I'll just build businesses that make money. Mm-hmm. And like, I think that is a much better model. If you're tempted to do a venture studio, like don't do a startup studio, like just incubate companies and put them together. And that allows you to do something really interesting called make money, which is fun.
Something that a large percentage of our audience knows nothing about. Making money is not, I mean, now it's back in it's in vogue again. For years though, it was very much out.
I feel like Taylor Swift. I've always been in style.
Yeah, there was this last thing on this. There's this retired VC. Speaking of my fancy adjacent to Silicon Valley world, I feel like I'm telling a lot of adjacent to Silicon Valley world stories, but they're good. So this guy was a VC at a very big firm for many years, and when he retired, he did the biggest VC thing possible. He bought, like, I don't know, 40 acres of land in Napa Valley, and he and his wife and one of his adult sons started this like wine brand, and they're making $300 bottles of wine. And at this party, he was like giving a toast or something about like why he started this winery. And he said it was the first company as a VC he was ever involved in that turned a profit. He was like, I was involved in companies that had revenue, but like I've never like been a part of a profitable company. And so I had to like start this winery to like do something that like actually like made money at the end of the day. Very telling. for, I think, a whole generation of VCs probably have similar-ish experiences. So
anyway, I was just looking back through my notes to see if there's anything here. I mean, look, the Sutter Hill guys, like, I love how cryptic they are about their model, because that means they figure something out.
Yeah.
Like, they 100%. They know what they're doing. But I don't know if it's replicable. I mean, you look at it and you're like, how many things are Google building for scale, right? How many of those things can you actually take and replicate and do elsewhere? Like, I think there can only be one Sutter Hill doing this.
Have you seen their website? Have you gone to shv.com?
No, I'll do it now.
This is, to your point, this is how you know that they've made it and that they've nailed the model. It's like,
there's nothing here.
There's nothing. It's that you don't even have an email address. It's like, we're off the grid. We have our address, probably because like the SEC or somebody requires us to like have a page with like a physical address on it. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've talked about this before. Like, the more baller a firm is in most, like it's the Berkshire Hathaway kind of effect. The more baller it is, the shittier the website.
Yeah. If you have like YouTube clips and like fancy art on your homepage, you're not building a baby Berkshire. This is like the baby Berkshire right here. Of like,
you just described my personal homepage. P.S. subscribe to my newsletter.
P.S. like and subscribe.
I was talking to this investment banker, and we were talking about it. We'd gotten connected to him, and he was great, like super smart, sharp, likable, like everything you'd want an investment banker. And he like heard about our deal, and he's like, "Oh, sorry, I only work on stuff worth more than $500 million." And I was like, "Oh yeah, okay, what's your website?" And he's like, "It was a website," and it was like, it was just their logo.
Yeah, that's amazing.
That was the whole thing. Just like, "Oh, here you go, sucker."
Yep.
That's so super funny. All right. So, okay, Chris, how am I gonna make money through from all this? What do I need? What about this is gonna teach me to make money other than, well, so far it's like, don't do a venture studio. That seems to be what we've coalesced around.
Don't do a startup studio. Don't do a venture studio. I mean, go be a founder and own 100% of your own company and then raise from VCs. Or if you want to incubate things like this, you can cut $50,000 checks into real businesses that make real revenue from day one. And those are probably the two ways, like the most consistent ways to wealth is like, go start a real business that makes money. And if you want to go do the venture thing, like, do it the right way and don't give up more than 15-20% of your company in the seed. And then you still have like a very long runway to hopefully run it. So I think that's what you and I have done respectively in terms of like how we built things. And it's like a tried and true model. All of this weird stuff in between where like, you're kind of venture scale, but you're not really getting VC dollars in the beginning. Like, it just, maybe you as an outlier will make it work, but it seems to be like 3 out of 1,000 companies have like really made money doing this, which is a pretty shit hit rate.
Now, I will tell you, I think there is a good business here, which like you look at it and like Pioneer Square Labs does this. Some of these other guys do it. You're a GP who has a venture studio. Like, if you can get investors to give you money, which like Pioneer, I forgot how much Pioneer Square Labs is raised, but it's like over $100 million. Like, mm-hmm. like, okay, that's a good business to be in. I'm all over that. Yeah. Like, using your own money, it seems tough. But I do think, you know, as I look back on my career, the investments that have paid the best, there's an inverse correlation to how much I invested. Like my very best investment, which I will not disclose what it is, but like I invested $40,000 to start a business. It pays me that like hundreds of percent return per year of that initial investment, and it's compounding and growing. And it's like, oh, okay, like I want to keep doing this. Mm-hmm. But the things where like I've put like six figures into, like they're sucking. Mm-hmm. It's not fun.
Yep.
So there's something to it. It's like, you know, like, okay, well, like, and that's one of the things, like when I'm incubating stuff now, I'm like, okay, like, you know, with the associates that I have, I'm like, okay, we have $50,000 budget for this.
Yep.
And we can spend all of that. And if we're not profitable by then, like we're shutting it down.
Yep.
Like that's the whole
Love
thing.
It. That's a good way to do it.
So, and we're going to launch, we're launching a new business this weekend and hopefully it'll be quiet launched. And the in total investment, we did the budget. It's like $24,000. It's like, nice. It's good money, but like, I'll know, you know, that's the extreme level of risk I'll take. And other than that, it should never lose money again.
Yeah, the last way, you know, one idea that you could easily do with 50 grand here is a good way to make money in startup studios is every year, or at least, you know, over the last 10 years, every year there's, you know, 1,000 people in the US who become super wealthy, like crazy wealthy from tech companies, right? Their company went public, they were an early employee. Somebody should create the course that tells them all the economics, all of the deals, like the way to set up a startup studio. Who cares if it works? Like, it probably won't. But like, if you want to use your own money to start a startup studio, you're going to go put $100 million of your own money in this thing to go get a fancy office in San Francisco. We're going to sell you the $50,000 course on how to do this. All we need is like 5 of those people buying that thing.
You know, I think it was like, did you see the thing from Levi James where he talked about the peer group that he's part of for investing?
No.
This guy that he's joined, he tweeted about it. He joined this mastermind up in Austin of like lifestyle investor guys. And the guy that runs it charges $55,000 a year to be in 12 phone calls a year and get connected to the deal flow.
Amazing.
I was like, what?
It's almost Grant Cardone level. Good.
$10 million if you get it. Well, okay. So here, let's do a lightning round, Jeopardy. Who's a bigger grifter, Grant Cardone or the guy that's the, what's his name? Tate.
It's got to be
Ballers,
Tate.
Ballers
Tate.
Academy. Which one is the bigger grift?
Oh, man. I'd say Andrew Tate. I think it's a bigger grift. That's a tough one. That's like one of those good, that's a good question. I'll probably regret saying that. But, you know, here's the thing is if you're, you know, Tate's like preying on like 14 and 15 year old boys to pay him like $20 a month to be in his like Discord or something. Yeah. Cardone is getting $2,500 LP checks from people who probably can't afford it, because if you could afford it, you would understand the economics behind his deals are terrible. I don't know like which one of those things is worse, but they're both pretty net negative on society, but they've both become quite wealthy from doing so. What do you think? Which one's worse?
It's tied for first.
Yeah.
Yeah. I give them both. They're both they're both below my line.
Below the line. Chamath.
Thing. Oh, clip that out. They're all below my line.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was just trying to look and see if there's anything else from my prep that we want to make sure. We talked about how, like, you look at these, all the venture studio companies are crap. Like, I think that's my judgment. I'm like, who thinks this is a good idea? Like, the problem is, it comes back to this idea that we talked about, where a venture studio, like the best venture ideas look terrible. Mm-hmm. Like they have to look horrible, right? Like Coinbase, like the initial pitch was you're going to put all of your money into this like funny internet money, and then we're going to host it for you in a centralized like repository where it can all get stolen.
No one knows who created this funny money. It's an unknown guy. Maybe the FBI created it, but no, this is going to be a big thing. Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, it's mostly used to spy drugs on the internet. Like,
yeah, everybody associated with it has like committed suicide, been arrested by the FBI, or has like ended up like, you know, like having to move to Malta on their yacht to avoid authorities. But no. This is like a good venture backable business for sure. Yeah,
you're going to be a billionaire.
It's amazing.
Which by the way, like every time I see a company say, okay, guys, we've decided to not be political here. I'm like, well, wait a second. Like you just decided to be political. Like
100%.
Like, but the track record is really bad for companies that have done this. Like Coinbase did it. Who are the guys, the Basecamp guys have done it. Like yep. I was told by somebody who worked there, like the moment they decided to make everything apolitical, which made it political by definition at Basecamp, the culture went to shit. Like everybody turned negative and like defections happened. Like the whole company is basically unwound because they decided to be apolitical, but they were being political by doing it. Like,
right.
So I don't know. Everybody just needs to keep their business at home, show up, and we can do our jobs. That's what I think.
These companies always become apolitical at like key moments in time. It's like January 6th happens, and then January 7th is like, we're apolitical. Like BLM protests are happening, and it's like, we're apolitical. It's like, that's a weird time for you to pop up and say that you're apolitical about something on both sides of the spectrum, right? So it's like, I think we know where these companies are landing. And yeah, the inside of them has to be like a shit show culturally. Another topic for another day.
Yeah, 100%. We should totally talk politics when Alex is here and I can tell him he's wrong.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. And so like, are you agreeing or disagreeing with me that you can do venture studios style stuff, but like it doesn't work for high variance things. Like, doesn't work. It could work for small businesses. I just don't see how it works for venture-backed startups.
I totally agree. I would be so skeptical of like some new model that looks similar to how a startup studio, venture studio, has come out in the past, saying like, we have a new method for creating all these like billion-dollar companies. It's not going to happen. Maybe you have a new method for creating companies that cash flow $100,000 a month, which is awesome. I think more people should do that. Right. Or it's like a traditional seed fund. You got to fall on one side of the spectrum there.
100%. Yeah. I can say doing the $100,000 a month incubation, that's hard work. I think that's a challenge. Like, if you are, you know, this retired rich guy, and like you suddenly sell your business for monster money, you have $50 million. Do you really want to piddle yourself around for businesses that are doing $4 million a year in revenue with proven business models? Like, maybe not be that much fun.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and that's kind of where I mean, I'm not there for sure. Like, but it's a situation where I want to keep incubating companies, but like, for me, they need to have a high ceiling. Like, right. I need to see a path to where it could get someday to 100 million in revenue. So that's why I'm like, I don't want to incubate like a auto repair shop, like just not interested, you know, my buddies are doing like franchisees for like some chains. And I'm like, yep, you will make a lot of money. But like, the opportunity for that to compound and get to 100 million in revenue or $1 billion valuation or even 20 million in revenue, like, it's not going to happen. Unless you just get lucky, you know, and end up buying 30 franchises and grind it out for 30 years, that can happen. But anyway, I think there's a balance there. But yeah, I just don't understand the venture studio model. And maybe nobody else does too.
Cool offices, though. Would love to be invited. If anybody out there is running a venture studio, wants to invite me to a dinner, I'll
be
there.
That's like the hallmark of death, right? There's this thing, by the way, this is the last story, by the way. Like, when I was running the fireworks business, I would always, and we would deal with these like little towns, and I would always know when the little town was going to go to crap, because they would build like a huge multi-million dollar city hall. Like, that was when they would build a huge multi-million dollar city hall, that's when they would get this idea that they were like something bigger than a 4,000 person town out in the middle of nowhere. And they would think that, oh, like, this is Palo Alto now, buddy. Like, you need to respect, or what is it from the Big Lebowski? It's like, stay out of Malibu, Lebowski. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's basically what it would turn into.
Yep.
But when I would see that happen, I'd drive through the little town and be like, new city hall. Things are going to crap soon. Get ready for some action.
It's all over. Cause you've got to, you're going to need new like laminate flooring in 10 years. Then you got to create a budget. Everybody's taxes go up. Right. And they just move to a smaller, shittier town. So, yeah.
Well, you start recruiting like these like city managers and executives that think their poop doesn't stink because they now have work in this big fancy city hall. And, you know, like, it just snowballs into this mess. Whereas like, no, you're a podunk town, have a podunk city hall. This is fine.
Yeah.
Totally fine.
Parks and Rec style. Yeah. You know?
I think the same thing. Like, my office is like, maybe things will change someday, but like, for now, like, my office, well, I'm in a home bedroom right now, but like, my office is like not that nice. Like, it's just functional. And, focus on what matters, not fancy offices. Give me a break.
But really, invite me to your fancy office if you have one.
When we meet in person.
If you're going to serve like a steak dinner, like a Michelin star chef is going to cook for me, I'll be there.
Thank you for doing this. I appreciate you reaffirming my priors. So,
such a bad model. So terrible.
This is going to make a great podcast.
Yeah. Cause like, right. We have some of these people that follow us and listen to the pod. And so maybe they'll have second thoughts and, I don't know, maybe we won't change hearts and minds, but we'll try.
In the end, who cares? Maybe they'll invent the next Dollar Shave Club. I mean, the funny thing about a lot of these things that turn out to be like graduates that turn into money for these individual venture studios, like, they don't turn out to be long-term great businesses. They just found a sucker willing to pay for them.
Yep.
It's like, oh, you incubated a scooter company? Oh, it sold to Ford? Oh, it sold to Jeep? Like, congratulations, you got lucky. Nailed like, it. Good luck. Here's a great example of that. Like, all the food delivery startups, like, they're terrible businesses. Like the corporations that bought them, like Target, like the different like grocery store chains and stuff like that, like, they all, the only reason those businesses are even close to breaking even is because the delivery allows you to charge the brands, Procter & Gamble and Dr. Pepper, Snap-on, all these people to promote your stuff. But eventually, like, they're going to figure that out. It's like the NFTs of, like, grocery. Like, they're going to stop paying you because they realize it doesn't make a difference.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, it just ties back to, like, a lot of times venture doesn't really matter if you're working on a good idea. It just matters if you're working on an idea that somebody else is going to think a good idea 3 or 4 years from now and throw some stupid money at it. Like, 100%. And I think that all kind of ties back to the greatest, like, the... What's it, Marissa Mayer, like when she started buying companies for Yahoo, and I was like, I got to start an incubator just to sell companies to Yahoo. Like, that's the key thing here.
Yeah, she's just got buying cash. Anything. Yep.
Just buying anything. These weren't even good companies. Weren't even good companies. Don't get me started. I got myself started. All right. Sorry. Gridley rant.
Hold on.
All right. Wrap it up here.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. See ya. Bye, everybody.